Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Recent data suggests entrepreneurship is in decline across Canada. Are people choosing to move away from a self-employed lifestyle? And what are the consequences of lower levels of small business ownership across Ontario? Let's discuss that with Jeff Cool. He's Executive Director of the Northwestern Ontario Innovation Centre. Nancy Wilson, founder and CEO of the Canadian Women's Chamber of Commerce. Nadia Ladek, Program Marketing Officer at Startup Canada and co-founder of Marlo, a menstrual product company. And Joel Blitt, Associate Professor at the University of Waterloo and a Senior Fellow at CG, the Center for International Governance Innovation. And it's good of all of you to join us here at TVO tonight. Can I give extra props to him? You came all the way from Thunder Bay for this.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for coming, Jeff. Sheldon, let's start with this. Let's start with this graphic off the top. Last October, the Business Development Bank of Canada released a study that said, among other things, that Canada has 100,000 fewer entrepreneurs today than 20 years ago. And if you do the stats, only 1.3 of 1,000 Canadians started a business in the year 2022. That's down from 3 in 1,000 Canadians in the year 2000. And a third of new businesses close in the first 5 years. Okay, some disquieting numbers there. Jeff, what's your big takeaway from this BDC study?
Well, I'm happy that there are some numbers to kind of back up what we've been feeling anecdotally, especially in Northwestern Ontario. Like, I'm based out of Thunder Bay, and we see that just based off of the number of entrepreneurs coming through our doors. Those numbers are a great starting point because it's a complex issue, right? There's a lot of nuance, especially for serving all these different communities. So excited to get into it today.
We are going to pick it apart over the next half hour. Nancy, how did you react?
So the BDC study and the stats that they give are only telling half the story. Their stats are based on a narrow definition of entrepreneurship, which is self-employed people with paid employees, so employers only. If you look at self-employed people without paid employees or solopreneurs, that number is actually increases over the same period. So it's really a question of how are we getting folks from startup to further down the line in their business development.
Okay, Joel, allowing for that distinction, is this still something we ought to be concerned about?
Yeah, I think we should definitely be concerned. I think that is a good distinction. There's many other distinctions that we could make as well. How many of these are tech startups? How many have IP? So there's lots of different measures that we could look at, but I do think it's an interesting set of data. Certainly, we're interested in entrepreneurial ventures that hire people, and so I think it is useful for sure.
How about in your world? How does this study appear to you?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a big issue. We need to be encouraging more and more people to go into entrepreneurship, but I think it's also supporting the entrepreneurs that we already have. So, you know, for me personally, in my experience, I am an entrepreneur. One of the biggest challenges is the lack of access to funding, and especially at that earliest stage when you don't have a lot of traction, you don't have a lot of proof of concept, you can't qualify for a lot of the funding from traditional banks, from venture capital firms. And so being able to support people at their earliest stages of the journey, because one of those stats was that one third of the businesses will fail in the first 5 years because they don't have the access to those resources and support to go to that growth stage, to your point.
Jeff, just play it out for us. If a country, generally speaking, is becoming less entrepreneurial, play that out down the road. What does that look like 10, 20 years from now?
Well, if you think of the numbers in our economy right now, 98% of our businesses are considered small businesses, right? That's under 100 employees. And they are employing close to half of our private sector workforce. And they generate over a third of our GDP, just over a third. And so any type of risk hitting those communities, those drivers of those numbers, could potentially have a profound effect. And so if we look at one scenario where, let's just say, we shift those numbers a little bit so that some of our GDP is no longer generated by those small businesses because they no longer exist, Well, that's going to shift to our medium and our large enterprises. That increases our dependency on those organizations. So we might lose, you know, 10,000 small businesses, and that GDP is now generated by a handful, 3 to 5 larger businesses. If one of those businesses exits our economy for whatever reason, could fail, could offshore, could just want to relocate their headquarters, we don't have that diversity in our economy, that resiliency that we would have had if we had been relying on those small businesses to generate those numbers.
Okay, so Joel, this is problematic. And the question obviously is, why is it happening?
Well, it's happening for lots of reasons. Let me first say, it absolutely is problematic. I was listening to our finance minister table the budget yesterday, and what I think she clearly said, and she was right, is our young people are looking around thinking, we're not going to have the opportunities that our parents did. And we have to ask the question, why? Well, it's fundamentally because for the past 5 decades or so, we've had a productivity gap, we've had an innovation gap, and an economic growth gap. And the way to address that is by having Canadians do better work, more efficient work, create better products and services that command higher value. And of course, our businesses can do it, but so can our entrepreneurs. Our entrepreneurs are going to be a key factor here. And what really worries me, to add on top of this, is we are at a very important moment in time where AI is about to transform over the next decade our economy and our society. And if you look at the last big technology, the internet, we had these great companies coming out like Amazon that reinvented retail around the internet. And we had Facebook reinventing social networks. The same is going to happen around AI. But the only way that we can get there, we can have some of these future Amazons, is by having lots of entrepreneurs. And that's why this is so worrying for me. This is more worrying now than ever before.
Now, well, yeah. And Joel says this is a problem that's been going back 5 decades, but I have to presume that COVID was a particular shot in the ribs to this whole issue. Is that a fact?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, the idea of creating more Amazons, creating more Facebooks, that to me is not necessarily what we want. I mean, there's all sorts of concerns about Facebook and Amazon and you know, having everything, all of our eggs in one basket. I agree that AI is, you know, the new thing. But I think that there are systemic issues that that are in place that prevent certain demographics from realizing their value.
Like what?
Like all of our social safety net right now, in terms of income support, maternity leave, all of these other things are tied to traditional employment. It's all about the workforce. And when the government calls for more women to become entrepreneurs, for example, there's no policy support, there's no infrastructure for those women who become entrepreneurs and then fall into the one-third that fail. So there needs to be, I think, from the government in order to boost entrepreneurship, there needs to be some kind of policy infrastructure to actually support that.
Well, we got an honest-to-goodness example right here. You started a business. Tell me how you did it.
So I actually started in my last year of university, and we were taking an entrepreneurship capstone course. I went to Western, the Ivy Business School, and I remember our professors told us to start by finding a problem that you're passionate about solving. And I think that's the key thing with entrepreneurs is they're working on the world's to-do list and all the challenges that we're facing around sustainability and climate change. All these types of technologies that we're creating are going to solve these world's problems. And so I think in addition to the economic growth and some of the other points we're talking about, it's also being able to solve these problems that we're facing and actually bring some of these technologies to market.
So you are living the life of an entrepreneur right now.
Yes.
How old are you, can I ask?
25.
You're 25.
Yes.
You're a small business person. You're an entrepreneur. You do not have the security of, mm-hmm. say, somebody who works for the province of Ontario in an office job down at Queen's Park.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what's your life like?
It's definitely hard, a lot of challenges. A lot of people say that you face the highest highs and the lowest lows, sometimes within the same day. You're trying to, you know, you do things like this where you're talking about your business, but you're also trying to manage your employees, manage your inventory, manage your cash flow. So a lot of entrepreneurs, about 73%, according to the BDC study, struggle with their mental health, struggle with these types of challenges where they're trying to navigate through the ups and downs of entrepreneurship. So it's definitely hard, but you know that you're making an impact. And especially in my space where I'm working on menstrual health, something that impacts 50% of the population, I'm actually waking up every day and solving these problems and making an impact for a lot of different people.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Lawrence Park.
In Toronto?
In Toronto.
Did you at any point while you were a high school student think to yourself, of course I am going to be an entrepreneur?
Definitely not. It's not something that's taught enough in high schools. And I came from an immigrant household where entrepreneurship was not normalized as a potential career path. All my parents wanted was for me to get that stable corporate job. And I got it. And I came home one day and said, yep, I'm going to quit that job to work on this tampon business that has no funding yet, nothing available. But I think it is important to teach more students that this can be a career path. It's not just about encouraging more students to be entrepreneurs, but encouraging them to embrace the skills that you get as an entrepreneur, embracing this growth mindset where it's okay to fail, where it's okay to take these as learning opportunities, where you can learn about so many different types of areas of business like marketing, finance, operations, encouraging them to have resiliency. And whether or not they become an entrepreneur, they take these creative problem solving skills into the organizations that they work for, and they think differently and they try to solve problems. So not just encouraging more people to become entrepreneurs, but embracing the skill sets that you gain.
Nadia, you know your big problem? Lack of energy. You are just not really energetic enough in the way you approach the world. No, I'm kidding. All right. You just heard her talk about high school. Now, you're in the post-secondary sphere, where by that time, people already have a sense about what they want to be. But what about her point about high school? Do we put enough focus there on letting people know that entrepreneurship is an option for them going forward?
I think definitely not. But, and Nadia's story is super inspiring. I was smiling and happy the whole time. That's what we need. We need a lot more Nadias in this country. And I think we do need to start in high school. We need to start putting that thought in people's heads right from the very beginning, that this is a possibility, this is what it could look like, these are the opportunities around it. I know you're asking about high school. I can tell you a lot more about university level.
Sure. So
what our approach really is that it's sort of a pyramid. And so if we want to get as many entrepreneurs coming out of Waterloo as possible, then we need to reach out to as many students as possible. So we're reaching out to more than 1,000 students every year, involving them in some degree, trying to get them interested, just thinking about the idea of entrepreneurship. And so step one is, how do we pick those people that might be interested? Those that are interested then go to the next step of the pyramid, and we get them thinking about, okay, what are the big, as Nadia was mentioning, what are the big problems in the world? And how do you try and solve some of those? But just think about problems and get them engaged with problems. And then you can think, okay, well, how do I create a startup to solve those problems? How do we support them through it? How do we give them the business acumen? How do we give them the mentorship? And then you can start thinking about funding, creating ventures, et cetera. Some of these numbers that you were mentioning earlier, we have a decrease in entrepreneurship overall. I can tell you at Waterloo, it's alive and well. We've doubled from 2022 to 23. We more than doubled the number of student entrepreneur teams. I think we now have something like 500. I could have that number wrong, but over 500. And it's quintupled since the pandemic.
Okay, here's the thing, though. You talked about a pyramid, which, of course, has a big base at the bottom, but ultimately there's a lot of failure on the way to the Absolutely. Point where by the time you get to the top, it's a very small number. Don't you really want to create a square as opposed to a pyramid?
Ideally, I think it's very hard to create that square. I think part of entrepreneurship is there's going to be lots of failures. A lot of people are going to be pulling out. And that's why you have to make that base as wide as possible.
Okay. So tell us, Jeff, what do you need to know as a young entrepreneur in order to have success later in life?
Oh, great question. I think, as Joel was mentioning, one of the big lessons is that failure is not a bad thing. It's quitting that is the bad thing. So you're going to learn the most from your failures or the things that don't go well or as well as you thought they would be when you were looking through with rose-colored glasses and thinking that we are going to change the world on day one. So that would be my number one lesson to people. And when they come in our doors is, even if idea one doesn't work, being an entrepreneur is it's a mindset. It's kind of a lifestyle.
Yeah, I've heard if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when you fail, try to find out, okay, what did I learn from this? How can I pivot? What do I need to tweak? So that way the next business I look to get started in, I have a much higher likelihood of success.
Let me circle back to something you said a moment ago, Nancy, which it sounded like you were saying women have unique problems, distinctive from everybody else in the marketplace in terms of trying to make this a life that works.
Absolutely.
Build on that if you would. How do you mean?
So 80% of women identified entrepreneurs fall into the category of self-employed without employees. And a big reason for that is the issue of access to capital. There are major problems with accessing financing from lenders, from the VC and angel market, in order to grow their business, chronically undercapitalized. I'm sure you can speak to that. We're talking about, 2 to 4% of the entire VC investment dollars go to women.
2 to 4%?
2 to 4%. So it's not, getting there. It's dramatic.
Let me just jump in on that. Is the marketplace sexist? Or what's the story there?
So there's a bunch of things happening. There are certainly, there's systemic sexism and racism that is built into policy, that's built into, that can be improved. I have certainly lots of ideas about that. That's my job, to interact with government, advocate on behalf of our members. However, there's also a lot of other things. There's gender norms that that impact how people evaluate entrepreneurs. And there's research about unconscious bias. So a piece of research, for example, where venture capitalists, male and female venture capitalists, tend to ask women and men founders different types of questions. And that is shown to impact the likelihood of actually giving them funding and how much funding they get.
Okay, I don't want to take anything away from you from that argument that you're making. However, my hunch is he's going to make the same kind of argument in saying that it's easier to be a woman in Toronto trying to make a life for yourself in this area. Try doing it in Thunder Bay, or try doing it in Moosonee.
No doubt.
Am I onto something here? Is it even harder in rural and northern Ontario?
Sure. Being located in a remote area or a smaller city outside of southern Ontario presents its own unique challenges, for sure. One of the things that people may not consider is, any type of programming or supports that the various levels of government might offer, if they're offered, centralized out of Toronto or Ottawa, typically those two centers, lots of people in the north don't have high-speed internet. So how do you expect them to connect to a resource, to learn about the program, to ask questions about the application or anything like that, when they can't do a video call?
Can't even get to first base here.
Exactly. And the culture in most northern communities as well, it's all about face-to-face conversations. It's about being where the entrepreneur is, meeting them on their level, using their language with a program that is designed for them. And that's sort of universal as you're accessing different communities. I don't think I'm saying anything too shocking, but as in the context of the North, it's they want to meet with someone who lives in the North, who understands the way things sort of operate in the North, the scale of the businesses in the North, that uses language from the North. A great example is, you'll hear people talk about founder success or venture success. There is not an entrepreneur ever out of Northwestern Ontario that has described themselves as a founder or their business as a venture. So when somebody comes and approaches them and say, I'm from so-and-so's founder success team, they're like, oh, that doesn't apply to me. Right. I'm not a founder. They're reluctant to even use the term entrepreneur to assign themselves that label, let alone call themselves a founder. So those are just some of the things where we need to make sure that we are delivering programming that is designed for them, using language for them by people in the region, in order to have them subscribe and apply and take advantage of it.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Thunder Bay.
Why didn't you leave?
I did leave for a while, but I went back.
Why?
Which I think speaks volumes. So yeah. I was down in Toronto for about a decade. And I decided that that lifestyle wasn't for me. So I went back to Toronto, back to Thunder Bay about 6 years ago. I did my own entrepreneurial thing. Didn't work out. I'm one of those people it didn't work out for, but I found my niche now supporting other people.
Good for you. Yeah. Tell me about, we got a real life example here, so I want to continue to mine this. How much money did you determine that you needed to get your business started?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize, but tampons and menstrual products are medical devices. So I had to do a lot of R&D in the early stages, partner with labs, go through Health Canada approval. And so I needed a lot of money up front to start that. Then you have to start.
How much?
I raised $1 million to fund my business.
How does a 20, how old were you when you started this?
22.
How does a 22-year-old raise $1 million?
I think it's really difficult. To Nancy's point, only 2% of venture capital goes to women entrepreneurs. And for people of color that are women, it's 0.4%. So it's even worse. I found Canada has been very risk adverse when it comes to raising capital. It is very, very hard as an early stage entrepreneur to raise from Canada. So I actually went to the US and raised a lot of investment from US investors who are more willing to take these risks to fund ventures at the earliest stage without that traction, without that revenue.
But how does a 22-year-old from Toronto know where to go or who to talk to in the US to even get started?
There's a lot of support networks. So, you know, places like the Women's Chamber of Commerce, Startup Canada, there's a lot of accelerator programs. So our university definitely helped, but League of Innovators, Next 36, all these accelerator and support networks are really, really key because they taught us how to pitch your business. They connected us to mentors, connected us to different funders. And there's a lot of pitch competitions, demo days where you can kind of get exposure for your business. So that was kind of our entry point into the whole ecosystem. And now we've got connected to a lot of different players in the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Canada and the US.
I hear there be dragons in your past as well.
Yes, there
is
has.
Is that true?
That is. I did go on Dragon's Den as well.
And?
We got a deal with Arlene Dickinson, which was exciting. And I think it's not even just the deal, but the exposure you get from going on the show and connecting with other people and more people learning about it. Because it's hard as a small business to compete with some of the big competitors, especially in our space. We're going up against large CPG companies. And so being able to have supports like that, the support of the network and the ecosystem, that really helps to propel these businesses forward.
How fast did you blow through that $1 million?
We still have it, so we're still using
okay,
it.
Okay,
and we are raising a second round of funding as well. So being able to, as you grow, it becomes easier and easier to raise money. But definitely that earliest stage where we barely had a product, barely had any proof of concept, that was the most difficult time to get money.
Hmm. That's a hell of a story.
I agree. I want to hear more about the story. You know?
But this sounds, well, it sounds too unique, if you know what I mean, right? We need more of this happening, right? How do we make sure more of this happens?
Well, again, I think it's the idea of letting 1,000 flowers bloom. You want to encourage as much of it as possible. It's a pyramid thing I was talking about. But let me go to a point that Nadia mentioned, that it's really hard to get that early stage investment. Another thing we're doing at Waterloo, and I don't want to sound like a mouthpiece for Waterloo. I'm a professor. I have my independent opinions as well. But
sounding a bit like that, Joel. But anyway,
I know. Yeah. But just being in that ecosystem, it's hard to sort of separate. But Waterloo is creating its own fund. Right, so the university has realized, and Velocity and others, that it is a gap, and many ventures are starting to grow, and they don't have access to as much funding as they would like.
How much will be in the fund?
I don't know the exact number. See, I'm not a mouthpiece, but it's pretty significant. I think that the university endowment is investing in it, and there's going to be lots of external investors, so it's going to be pretty significant.
Government obviously has a role to play with this. Nancy mentioned that as well. Governments do bring forward programs. They are trying to do various things. Are they doing enough?
I mean, they can always do more. Look, I'll go back to what I was saying. I think we're at a specific moment in time where with AI, everything is about to change. I think the entrepreneurs are going to be driving the reinvention of so many industries. And so we need to double down. And so, you know, we just saw the $2.4 billion investment in the AI package. I think what's missing there is a lot more investment in bringing up literacy around AI and investing in entrepreneurship and technology adoption, that sort of thing. So can we do more? Absolutely, especially at this point in time.
Did you get government grants in your startups?
We did get government grants as well, but I think a big thing is also just lack of awareness. So there are resources, of course, there could be more, but a lot of entrepreneurs don't know how to navigate through the government funding. So I'm also the program marketing officer at Startup Canada, and one of our programs we have is Startup Government, where we bring in entrepreneurs and we host roundtables with government officials so that they can walk through the types of funding that are available. We try to give a voice voice to entrepreneurs to government. So I think also just having more programs like that where we can interact with government leaders, suggest policies, or the people in the trenches who are going through these experiences and being able to share what's actually happening on the ground, I think more programs like that will be really beneficial as well.
There's another one called Startup Visa. You involved with that?
So some of my colleagues are involved in it. The Northwestern Ontario Innovation Center is not involved directly in it. But the Startup Visa program is there in theory, I will say. It's in there to attract entrepreneurs that are willing and able to create businesses that can compete on a global scale. And I use that term global scale. That's taken directly from the IRCC's website, who administer the program. Unfortunately, that program's lead time right now for approval is 37 months. So it's just over 3 years. So I don't know if you know many entrepreneurs, but they're not that patient. They're excited. They're ready to go. They want to launch their business right away. And especially if you have someone that has the mindset of, I'm going to grow a global company, they're not waiting around 3 years to land in whatever country they want to be in to start their business. They're ready to go. They're going to find an easier path somewhere else to go to start that globally competitive business. So this is purely my opinion here, but those lead times need to come down by 90%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do you do that?
The answer to all your questions is money. Yeah. It's usually what it is. But I know there's... there has been increased resources and things like that given to the people administering these programs, but the lead time hasn't budged. So is it more resources? Is it too much red tape or bureaucracy in the approval process between the different organizations that are administering it versus the IRCC that is actually doing the final approval? Maybe there's opportunities in there. It's not, like I said, we're not deeply involved in that program, so I can't tell you too much on the ins and outs there.
I think there's a lot of room for changes in program design. I think the way the government designs their programs for entrepreneurship is a bit backwards.
Well, hang on. I got it here somewhere. They did have a program directed specifically, Women Entrepreneurship Strategy from 2018 to 2025.
Correct.
Okay, so that sounds like something that you would find favor with.
Sounds great.
But?
The Women's Entrepreneurship Strategy has done a lot of great things. I think their starting point was a problem right off the bat. The stated goal of the Women's Entrepreneurship Strategy was to double the number of women entrepreneurs from 2018 to 2025. That is not going to solve the problem. Women entrepreneurs have issues in growing their businesses. They're chronically undercapitalized, as I said. They have all of these other policy issues that are barriers to their success. So doubling the number of them is really just creating more struggling businesses trying to get access to the same capital.
Okay, but I've heard women in the past say things like, how am I supposed to go out and do all the things I need to do in order to grow my business and be entrepreneurial when, for example, childcare is still an issue in my life?
Absolutely.
Okay, but we've theoretically got $10 a day childcare for much of the country now, do we not?
Theoretically, absolutely.
Theoretically, we do, yes.
Absolutely. I'm not trying to race against other challenges and barriers and say women are the most hard done by. I'm trying to say that there are challenges and barriers that are unique to women-identified entrepreneurs, rural and northern entrepreneurs, racialized, Black, Indigenous entrepreneurs, and those unique challenges need to be addressed. Systemic challenges and barriers need systemic solutions in order for them to be overcome.
Okay. Can I tell you a little joke here?
Yeah.
This is a dad joke, forgive me. But when I was growing up, I think I'm older than everybody at this table here. When I was growing up, this is a while ago, there used to be a joke that, how do you start a small business in Canada? You start a large one and you wait a little while.
Right. Yeah.
Now, so... You laughed.
I like
that. Was a genuine laugh.
I'm a dad, too. Okay.
So, Jeff, take this on. Why should people think about starting their own business when basically we've heard around this table tonight that it's really hard and there's going to be a lot of failure. And at the end of the day, it may all be for naught.
Well, when you frame it up that way, it doesn't sound that rosy. But honestly, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about being an entrepreneur is a mindset and a lifestyle. There are people that are just driven to do that. Unfortunately, we are putting in a lot of barriers that might reduce their chances of success. So when we have new, we have a lot of, you know, recent college or university graduates that come through our door and things like that. And they're thinking about starting a business, but they get pulled away. And this is not to disparage anything, but they can go work at Walmart and earn, you know, close to six figures as a manager nowadays, straight out of college or university. That's
an easier
path. Darn enticing, given just the strong labor market that we have right now with lower unemployment. So sometimes making that argument is really difficult. But I think that if you have somebody there, like in your startup supports and things like that, that then help them navigate that pathway that they can take to be successful and to show them how, yeah, that's great. You can go and make six figures right now, but you have an opportunity to build something special. And here's the pathway that you can take to do that. If we have that sort of enablement for some of our younger entrepreneurs, I think that's a real pathway to success.
Do you remember the kids you went to high school with? Wasn't
yes.
that long ago?
Yes.
How many would you say went into entrepreneurship or starting their own business versus trying to get a job?
I think I'm pretty much the only one.
You're the one?
Yeah.
Are you making money yet?
We are making money. We didn't pay ourselves for the first year, but now we can pay ourselves. But I think even beyond the financial opportunity, it's just the impact. Like, what other person so young in their career can wake up and know that they're making a difference for so many people? The types of reviews we get because of people who are using our product and they say we're changing their life, they feel so much more comfortable. I never thought I would be able to do that at such a young age. And being able to meet other people in the ecosystem is so inspiring. I've met the founder of Starbucks and such cool people that are actually working on solving and changing the world. And so I think it's just, that's the biggest part, is growing your network and making an impact for so many people.
Howard Schultz, is that the guy? From Starbucks?
Yes, yes.
You met him?
Yes.
Where'd you meet him?
Through our accelerator program. So they always bring in different cool guest speakers that are big, successful entrepreneurs. And a lot of people, I think that's one of the nice parts about entrepreneurship too, is a lot of people were in your shoes at one point. So they want to give back. They want to give advice. They want to help kind of grow the next generation of entrepreneurs.
Okay. Tell me to mind my own business if this is not my business, but what are your revenues today?
We are making revenue past six figures. So we're really proud of how much we've been growing so far.
And 10 years from now, where do you want to be?
We want to be a huge global brand. We want to have a suite of products. We want to be educating people across all stages of their reproductive health so that they can have access to comfortable products and education.
I have no doubt she's going to do it, right?
Absolutely.
I have no doubt.
And are you going to stay in Canada?
Both. Canada, yeah. U.S., big global yeah. brand.
Okay.
Outstanding. Mr. Director, can I have a wide shot of everybody at the table here, please, so I can thank all of you for coming from near and far to join us here at our table at TVO tonight. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.